Well, hello and welcome to the Reconstructionist Podcast, where we are helping you reconstruct while you deconstruct so you don't self-destruct. So this week I have on a person I've been trying to get on for a while, and at one point almost had on, but then had misplaced the email that she had responded back to me agreeing to it. And that is someone called Bethany Allen. If you don't know Bethany, she works at a church that you might know called Bridgetown Church down in Portland. It was a church that John Mark Comer originally founded and planted, and now that Tyler Staton is the lead pastor of. And we kind of dive into a bunch of different things. She's a spiritual formation pastor over at Bridgetown and has been for its entire life. And so we talk about spiritual formation and the importance of the practices in churches and in our lives. And then we talk about what it's like to be in a church and go through that transition period of having someone like a John Mark Comer and having them leave, and how the church was able to handle that and do what a lot of larger churches can't do, is survive that kind of exit from one leader and the coming in of another. And then we also talk about how Bridgetown has recently done the hard work of working through their thoughts and views on women eldership and what they think about that. And so we talk about that and some of her history with that and her different feelings and all those different things. And so I really enjoyed my conversation with her, and I think you will as well, where it was really, really honestly great. And so without further ado, here is Bethany Allen. Well, hello, Bethany. How are you? How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm great. I've tried to interview you for a while now, actually. I reached out to you like a year or two ago, and I just thought you never got back to me. And then I realized that you did. And I completely dropped the ball.
I do know that, Aiden. It's all coming up now, out in the open.
I know. I felt bad. But I'm happy that you didn't feel offended enough to never return. And so I'm pumped to be able to talk to you, because specifically with Bridgetown and you guys and the stuff you've done has been very influential on my life and the way I see church, especially because I started diving into you guys around the time I was in Bible college. So it's really shaped the way I see church and spiritual life. But for those who don't know who you are and like what you do and all that stuff, can you just give a quick intro to yourself and who you are and what you do and what you're about?
Yeah. I mean, that's always a tough question, isn't it? But I'll give the facts. Like you said, my name is Bethany Allen, and I am the pastor here at Bridgetown for spiritual formation and leadership development. I'm also an elder in our community and on the teaching team. So those are kind of my three primary roles. And I have been at Bridgetown since its origin, like since its birth.
Oh, wow.
So I'm like a long timer is what we call it. Two of us call ourselves. So I've seen Bridgetown kind of move through all its iterations to where it is now. So that's kind of what I do. And yeah, I'm a native Floridian, originally from Florida, but made my way out to the Pacific Northwest for seminary quite a few years ago. And now I can do both, which is pretty impressive. But that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, that's awesome. So for Bridgetown, now my history could be wrong, but from my understanding of reading some of John Mark's books and stuff, is that it originally was like a bigger church that was part of a bunch of different things. And then eventually John Mark was like, hey, I don't like this anymore. I can't sustain this. And it switched to then being Bridgetown, where it kind of became its own church separate from the other campuses, I think. And is that when you came into it, or did you come into it even before that happened? Or is my history completely wrong and I'm just like lying right now?
That was a decent attempt. I'll give you that. You're very close. maybe I'm just going to say it the same way or a different way. We were part of a large church in the suburbs of Portland, and we're kind of planted out of that. So then when we got planted downtown, we were one church, three locations. So we were technically a campus. And then about 3 years in, we became our own 501c3 and became officially Bridgetown Church. So you're right about that. I came in right as they planted in 2010. So I only attended downtown for a while because we were one church, three locations. I was operating with some of the other sister churches at the time, but I didn't precede our actual plant downtown.
Interesting. So for you and for those who don't know the context, what shifted in Bridgetown specifically where they decided that they were going to kind of, after 3 years of doing that, they were kind of do their own thing and become their own entity to some degree? Like, what initiated that for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a couple things. And really, I think it was, I just want to say it because I think it's helpful. It was a natural progression when God was really growing our community and doing leadership across three large churches is pretty difficult. And you mentioned it because you've read John Mark's book, but at the time it was a lot for John Mark to oversee, to cast vision for, to steward. And it just isn't what he wanted to do. That wasn't what his dream was. Mm-hmm. And he had had a dream years and years before that to actually, when he first came on staff with his dad at that larger church, to plant downtown. So he had always had this long-term vision of doing that. So when the opportunity came and God began to bless what we were doing, it was like, this feels like the natural progression to become our own kind of plant. There are other things as churches begin to grow that just naturally bend differently, leadership styles, view on women. Just different theological preferences that also, they weren't the reason why, but they are part of what happens when a church takes on its own culture. And those things were true for us as well at that point. But that's why we began to make that shift. So
yeah, that's super interesting. Well, and for you guys too. So 2015 would have been when I started to become aware of Bridgetown Church. So I went to a Bible college, and I'm Canadian, so I went to a Bible college called Briarcrest.
Awesome.
Yeah. And so I was there, and I don't remember how, but all of a sudden we just became aware of Bridgetown Church, and specifically became really interested in your guys' emphasis on spiritual practices. And it felt really unique in the sense of like, I grew up Baptist. And so for most of my life, the only practices that existed were just prayer and reading your Bible, which is like, yeah, that covers a lot of stuff. But it was interesting then to be like, oh, like, what is all this stuff? And as I was in Bible college too, learning about church history and all of that, that it became really interesting to see a church that was emphasizing spiritual practices specifically and being like, how do we actually live out the Christian faith? Because often it's just intellectual. A lot of the time, especially in church, that it's mostly thinking about stuff, but it actually became more about like, I don't know, embodying Christ-likeness. Mm-hmm. And so for you, because you are currently the pastor of Spiritual Formation, right? That is correct.
Yep,
okay. Right. That's still your title.
That's still what? It.
That's taken still it. So for you, obviously that would be something that's important to you. And especially it feels like more churches are doing it now, but at the time, at least from my perspective, it felt like a very unique thing that Bridgetown Church was doing that I hadn't really seen before. What made you guys feel like that was an emphasis you wanted to head into or something that you wanted to make important? And why do you think for the Christian life, those kinds of things are important? Not to say that people who don't, like, I don't know, like my church was great and reading your Bible and praying is great, but there are other things too. Why would those be an important thing to emphasize or talk about from your perspective?
Those are great questions. Should I hit the first one first?
Sure, whatever you want. There was a lot of questions in there. So.
Yeah, I'll just like shoot for it here. But I think you asked, I think this is an important part, at least for people understanding our journey, but also understand why we're so passionate about the practices. For us, you know, we're quite a secular city. And I don't know where you're from in Canada, but perhaps you're from a secular place too. Progressive and a beautiful city that's hyper-passionate, hyper-political, all these things. And in doing church here, we found that it was very easy to motivate people towards acts of justice or expressions of goodness or pseudo expressions of the kingdom in our city without actually experiencing transformation. So for us, part of the big movement towards the practices came when we had, it was the time when missional communities were like a huge deal. And so we had all these mission focused communities, and we realized that most of the people in those communities were not Christians. They were like doing God's work, but didn't actually, it wasn't coming from a place of like their own transformation. And that is a killer on multiple levels. So that was like our big aha moment, where we literally stopped the ship of everything we were doing and said, if we're really serious about people experiencing the reality of God's kingdom, if Portland is actually going to experience the kingdom of God crashing into it, then it starts with the work that we do through discipleship and how are people and really considering how people are formed and what needs to be unformed in them in order for them to receive the fullness of who God is and experience the power of the presence and all those things. So we made that pivot about 3.5 years in, which was brutal. But that was the time when we dreamed up what is now called Practicing the Way. And we sat in an office for hours and hours and hours and said, what's most essential? So like even some of the things you mentioned of like reading your Bible, praying, all that, we were like, those are good things. And I grew up Baptist too. So I was like, I definitely know how to do that. But what would it mean if we actually considered more broadly the definition of formation and explored that? And one of the people in the Baptist world who's so significant, who was significant in my Bible college experience, but I totally missed it, was Dallas Willard, who himself was Southern Baptist. Like, and I had read his works before, but we went back to some of these other guys and Richard Foster, some of these people, and then also went on a journey back to the early church, went on a journey back to Desert Fathers and Mothers. And we began to go, God, wait, we're seeing rhythms and practices that really shape not just individuals, but communities. And that's what we want to go after. So thus the practices became core to who we were. And we basically said, we're going to give our lives to this for 5 years. We're going to give all that we've got to formation work in our community. Through the container of communities, we're going to just push this work of practices and formation and see what God will do. And I can just tell you that he's done a whole lot since then. And our community was radically transformed. You asked the question, why the practice is important. And the number one answer I would give, or I think the most clear answer for us, is because the practices, if they're done well, are holistic. And one of the problems with, you know, the kind of 90s paradigm for formation, which I think is great in a lot of ways, is that it's not addressing the whole person. It's addressing parts of the person. And God has made us embodied, holistic humans who have all parts of our broke. We got all sin is affecting all parts of our brokenness. We need his life and his spirit and the work of being formed in every area of our life. And I think the practices and the disciplines afford us the ability to not just be transformed in two different ways or from three different angles, but all the way around, which makes them harder, more costly, but also more transformative. How's that? Yeah,
that's very good.
Okay. Should I get to keep my title or what?
You should get to keep your title. I'll write them an email. Yeah, that's very interesting. So for you guys, I'd imagine as a pastor and as someone who leads ministries, and especially coming into different church contexts, so I've worked for two different churches, and every church has great things about it and things where you're like, this is an issue. And there's obviously a direction that people feel that they want to lead people in. Did you guys find that when you made that shift, one, am I right in seeing that it was like a pretty hard shift where you switched pretty quickly, where it was like, this is very different, very suddenly?
Yes, you're correct about that. John Mark doesn't do anything lightly. So it was like, we're going to stop and start. And we were a church plant, which a lot of people can appreciate. So we were just like, okay, we're going to try something new. Like that totally didn't work. That wasn't doing what we wanted. So we literally hit the brakes and just did a 180. So,
yeah. And so looking at it from the outside and with all the history now and being able to see it like 10 years later, it's like, oh, this succeeded. But when you guys made that shift, did it feel like, oh, this was maybe we made a mistake? Or did it immediately feel like people were on board and like things were happening and wow, this is great? Or did you face pushback in times where you were like, I don't know if we made the right decision? Did that happen at all? Or was it just like instant success and you're like, yeah, great, we did it?
No, we're a church, so made up of people, which is, as you can appreciate, complicated, or, you know, it's never exactly the way you want it to be. I will say, there's a couple things that were really going for us. One, John Mark was a really trusted leader by our community. And we worked hard for that. Our pastoral staff continues to, but has always worked hard towards that to win the trust of our people. So that was there. Two, we were super young. Our church was made up of primarily 18 to 35, like max. So young people are usually up for a shift, you know, like we don't have a lot of sacred cows at that point. And we were only about 3.5, 4 years old. So those three things were like the spiritual silly putty or whatever that you need to make a shift like we did and have not a ton of pushback or feedback. Obviously, people had their opinions. People were bummed when we stopped missional communities because you're introducing a whole new vision for how we're meant to do things. But I would also say within the span of 6 months, and because I think, and this is really important, but we were 100% bought in as leaders. I think our people jumped in and began to see the fruit of it. And you have to remember too, like, I think I would say, I mean, John Mark and he's my friend, so I can say this, but he's one of the best teachers on the planet. Like, he's just unbelievable. And in those days, as he was exegetically teaching through the book of Corinthians, we were all like, our heads were falling off. It was like so explosive. And I told him that's like my favorite thing he's done. But so it wasn't like we were getting a lack of good teaching, but what we were getting a lack of was the ability to integrate that teaching into something that transformed us. And so our people were hungry for more than just what getting on a Sunday. So it also, that was a huge thing that was leveraged in our favor of like, this really catalyzed because our people were hungry for something more substantial than what they were getting. So
yeah,
nobody so perfect, cut me emails, the whole thing, you know?
No. But. So what did you see actually change in looking at what the church was and you're like, this is great, but there's things that we would like to change, to then after having done it, what is actually different about Bridgetown now than maybe before?
1,000 things. But I would say, well, I'll just start listing them and we'll see how many come, because I might say 3, but then I might say 12. So who knows? But one of the first things is that our church actually became a family. So when you create communities of 10 to 12 people who eat a meal together every week, who center themselves around the scriptures and Jesus, and who have a commitment of at least 1 year, that changes the fabric of that community. And if your church is made up of all of those, is almost everyone's in a community. And right now our church is like, more people are in community than attend on Sundays. So like, that's been the win for us. That changes the culture of the community, which makes it more hospitable to those who are far from God and makes it more alive when you gather. So that was one of the first signs of life, was like, oh, we're becoming a family in a different way. Two, I would say this, we're in a season of maturity, which means that we can catalyze or have greater opportunities for encounter with the Spirit. So when people don't really know Jesus, obviously a problem, don't really know him, or don't have space for him because there's healing that needs to take place, because there's transformation that needs to take place, you don't have opportunities for more or an increase of the Spirit of God. But as people are transformed, there's more room for that. So there's just been a deep work of the Spirit in our community because of, I believe, the maturity and the work that's being done at a formational level. And then I would say the third biggest thing is that we have people who genuinely do mission, not for the purpose of just seeing justice, but people who are actually motivated out of their own transformation to become kin or family, like Jesus would. This is the part of our DNA that says we want to be with him, become like him, and do what he did. People are doing what he did because of the transformation in their own life. And we're just seeing that radically catalyzed. So in our community, and the community is like, what the heck? But we're like, this is who Jesus is. So there's just all the things you hope to see in the scriptures, all the things you hope to be true. The Acts 2 realities are part of our community because of the work, I think, of these practices and what God's done through them.
Oh, that's super cool. And I found the same thing for me. So, for example, I've looked at a lot of what you guys have done and been inspired by it. And so even at my last church, and in this church, I'm working towards it, of introducing the practices, and to see the difference in people is really interesting. And even for, so I'm like a type 5 on the Enneagram. I love reading things. And for me, like reading the Bible and that being a spiritual practice always made sense to me. But to see other personalities be able to have practices and ways of connecting with God, that yes, that's important. I'm not saying that one, that's pretty foundational. But other things that even like my personality just naturally, like I hate silence and solitude. And I like all of that stuff just makes me so uncomfortable where I'm like, ah, because I'm a Westerner and because my brain's always working, I have ADHD, so it also adds to it. But to see people be able to dive into these other practices that are really meaningful, and for me too, to be forced to like be shaped in areas that make me uncomfortable, that need to be shaped, is actually really interesting to see. And so at my last church, when I shifted the youth ministry specifically to that, it was really cool to see. Yeah, like you said, how holistic faith became, that it wasn't just about, okay, I've got a list of like things I should do and shouldn't do. And like a lot of my spirituality is in my head. And it became more about like actually embodying what it means to follow Jesus in every area of life. Not that that can't lead to that, but yeah, it just puts an emphasis on it that's different. I don't have you for a lot of time, and there are a few things, there's two specific things in my brain that I kind of want to ask you about before you have to run, and I want to honor your time. But for you guys, so you planted this church, you were there from the beginning. At the beginning, having someone like John Mark, he's a great communicator, but it wasn't like, I don't know, if you went to New York, people really knew who John Mark was, who were Christian. And he eventually hit this point of becoming more widely known and widely read. And especially as he released books. It's just interesting to watch and wonder what that does to a church, and the kind of caution that you guys would have, where you don't want it to become the John Mark show, which obviously it's not now. But I remember even in the transition of John Mark resigning, because at that point he had become a lot larger of a figure in the Christian scene, where he had recently released Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, and that was huge. And I don't know if Live No Lies had come out yet. But he became this public figure, and where for a lot of people, he was a public figure versus just a pastor in Portland. And for you guys, because even in the shift, one of the worries you always have with a church where someone is very prominent and a very great communicator, but also someone who's now more of a public figure, the worries you have in shifting is like, uh-oh. Like, I just imagine, and this is a totally different scenario, but like the Mark Driscoll scenario of like Mark Driscoll leaves and Mars Hill dies. And that's always like your fear of like, what are people really here for? I really hope they're not here for John Mark. Mm-hmm. And for you guys sitting in that and going through that transition with Tyler, and even just watching that change where all of a sudden people like me in Canada are hearing about Bridgetown Church and looking at you guys as like a model of like, oh, this is really interesting. What was that like for you guys? And how did you make sure, because you guys are still alive and running, you didn't end up like Marcel, which again was a very different scenario, but is kind of like someone who becomes a large figure and then leaves. Like, you guys didn't like implode when John Mark left. You're still thriving. But how did you as a church make sure that as someone who was a pastor, and even for you guys as a church, were becoming more widely known, you weren't like this church plant nobody had heard of anymore, that you became someone who, yeah, people at Briarcrest were talking about. How did you navigate that in a way that made sure, okay, we're going to be healthy, that we're not going to let this get to our heads, and we're not going to put, I don't know, this is still about Jesus. This isn't about John Mark, which it could be very easy to build a brand and a church around one personality, because people do that. How did you make sure that your church was kind of in check, that that didn't happen and that wasn't the story for you guys?
Yeah, that's a big question. I will try to answer it best I can. One of the things I'll say, well, I need to say a couple things probably about John Mark. One, John Mark is a godly man who loves the church, and that's not rhetoric. That's like actually who he is, which means that his heart was there, was that priority. Mm-hmm. And he's so disciplined that that was something he was able to keep in front of him. Something we as elders and leaders, pastors at the church, worked really hard to keep the entire time. Like, you know, it's a funny thing when people talk about Bridgetown having influence to us, because we don't know a lot about that. Like, we're not, it's really weird. I know it doesn't sound, it couldn't be true, but it, we don't really, we actually don't know who's even paying attention or who would even know, like, because, and you know this, when you're really pastoring, you're just thinking about your church and you're like, it's made up of crappy people and good people and hard situations and funerals and weddings and real lives of people. So we didn't even, and I think in wisdom, John Mark really protected a lot of, protected us, our community as a whole from that. We just didn't know what we didn't know. So I'll just say, like, John Mark has heaps and heaps of integrity. And so, and humility, and both of those things guarded us at the beginning of the transition. We didn't fear the transition largely because we knew it was the Lord. So we had all discerned together his timing. His resignation wasn't on a whim. It was something we knew God had already started in his heart. We were in on that early on. And so this was part of the journey. So we were trusting the Lord for his provision and contending and praying for who would come next, knowing the mantle would be different. I think too, we are a church. So I know I said that just like a second ago, but it's true. Like, we are a church that is centered around Jesus. And yes, we cannot deny someone's gifting and their anointing. Like, without a doubt, this man is anointed and called and extraordinary. All that's true. But we have worked hard. We worked hard in building this community with him to be genuine pastors who knew and loved our people. So our people knew that about us. Our people were not here. We didn't worry that they were here for John Mark, because, and some did, some were, of course, but most of them, because of our structure of communities and spiritual formation, knew us, were loved by us, and served by us. And so they were here because they're part of our family. This is our church. And the dad is changing, but who we are is not. So I'll just say we really rest on that. We also hired a professional to help walk us through this kind of transition. We also hired another really gifted, brilliant leader. And I think that the other thing, the final thing I'll say is, when you have a gifted leader, and now this is our second one. So I've only worked for really brilliant, dynamic people who apparently have a lot of influence. So pretty good for me in pastoral ministry. But when you have a gift that the Lord, a gift of a person that the Lord is using to bless the larger church with, you are not aware of that. And you're also, our community is not, and we are not unaware of the fact that there's an open-handedness to how we hold them and their gifting. And so I think in our church community, no one was shocked about John Mark's wisdom, because most of them had followed him for 10 years. He had been their pastor. And so at some point you're like, we hold him loosely because he's traveling. He's being a voice to the world. We get to be a part of that. But we also bless him to do what he needs to do. So there was a real, there's just a knowledge about that when you have, I think, a leader like that present. If, and that's part of our work as pastors around someone like that, is to shepherd our people into how do you steward a gift like that. And that is one of the responsibilities we have had at Bridgetown because of who God's brought to lead. So that was a long answer to a big question. No,
it was really good. And well, and I think for me too, even in thinking about it, where I kind of had an epiphany of like, I actually think your shift, I think if you guys hadn't shifted to spiritual practices and community groups where people are actually forming like a family in church, I think if you left it as it's really about Sunday and coming and hearing this guy speak and singing songs together, that it would have been different. I actually think that maybe one of the reasons why you guys were able to be so healthy was because it constantly wasn't about who was on stage. And again, very gifted, very talented. It's not like that's not important to you guys at all, but it was that Bridgetown Church made a strong emphasis that this is about spiritual practices. It's about being formed by Jesus. It's about having community. And that's what we're about. And it set you guys up to actually go through a transition like that and have, you guys had done enough work that your church was in a healthy place spiritually, that everybody knew that this isn't about one person on stage. This is about us following Jesus together. And I think that that actually, because even again, it's not like you had a dud in your next pastor. Like Tyler's super talented and they're very different people. And you can even tell just in how they present, but even in conversation, because I met them briefly, but they are different people and they have different personalities and different things, but they're both very gifted. And so it's not like if you hired someone who was not, I don't know, quote unquote, good at their job, it probably would have been, would have been different.
Yeah.
So yeah. That helps. But it was the spiritual formation stuff. I really think that set you guys up to be in a healthy spot, that when that happened, it didn't, I don't know, do what it could have done and what it has done at a lot of churches where they lose the personality that it turned out people were coming for the personality rather than for Jesus. And that wasn't your guys' story. Yeah. And of course, there are people who did, but that's true of like a church of 200 in a rural town as well. So It's really cool. The last thing I kind of want to talk to you about, and I don't know if you're comfortable talking about this, but I've watched your journey and am curious about this. For you guys as a church, up until recently, hadn't had a strong stance on eldership for women, that you chose to have no stance, which Tyler jokes is actually a stance. That in the grand scheme of history, if you don't have a stance, there will be a stance that you will look back on and be like, well, they never had a female elder. So that kind of says where they were probably landing, unintentionally or intentionally. Right. But you guys walking through that journey, because you were a part of that committee, and I kind of watched it because I was curious and had watched the lectures that you guys did, which I think are super helpful, not just for your church, but I think even for people who are wrestling through this issue, because it is a large issue. That people are debating, and both sides have great points and faithful people on both sides. What has that been like as a church? So you, because I know that you addressed it too, which I think was really profound, that in the lectures I watched, it wasn't just like, here's what we came to the conclusion of, and that's it. And you either get in line or get out. That you really wrestled with, how do we not let, like all of the elders and all of the staff have wrestled through this in the committee. This is where we've landed. And it's actually unanimous in our studying, but we understand that there are going to be people in the church who now are like, oh, like I don't agree with this theologically and this makes me uncomfortable, or I don't know, vice versa. People who are just waiting for that day to finally happen. Mm-hmm. And you guys really emphasized it not being a thing that could possibly tear the church apart or to start different tribes in the church. Cause I know with things like that, as a pastor, there'll be people who want to have secret meetings together to be like, I can't believe that we're turning into a church that doesn't care about the Bible. Like that stuff happens, but you guys really addressed it really well and really emphasized unity and even space for people who disagree, that this is still a place, like you're welcome here. Like we love you. It's not like you need to agree with us or leave. What has that journey been like for you as someone who was on the committee? And as you, I don't know how long you guys spent studying it and talking about it. I don't know if it was a year or if it was more, but it was a significant chunk of time. What was that whole process like for you guys as a staff? And then in now transitioning to being like, okay, here's where we've landed. What have been the difficulties of that? And what have been the things that have been like surprisingly great about it from your perspective? Again, if you're like, I can't talk about this, that's totally fine. I understand.
So, I can talk about it. It's okay. I think that you're asking a unique person on the journey, because I have been at Bridgetown since its origin, and I have been the primary and only female for most of that journey on staff. Yeah. And in a pastoral or leadership position until recently. So I do have a unique perspective. It won't be as linear probably, but I think, you know, I think it's been one, it's been a good journey, but what people probably can't perceive and there were some parts of that night that were just for our family of stories three of us had told. But what people couldn't perceive is that, you know, pretty early on, we became our own 501c3. One of the conversations that was consistently on the table was about women. And that was because they had a woman in their midst who they were like, I think there's a pastoral gifting. And then moved to, I think there's a teaching gift. And so for years leading up to this moment, we had done, especially when I first come on within the first 3 years of me being on staff, we had come to a place of like, we need to have a conversation about what we believe pastor and elder means. And so we had done that work first couple of years in and affirmed women as pastors, which was different than the sending church or the mothership that we came from. And then it was, do we believe women can teach and teach at a gathering? What do we believe about that? So the background of the mothership church was Calvary Chapel. So hyper-conservative, think John MacArthur, the whole thing. I grew up Southern Baptist.
That is so interesting. Okay. That's very interesting, actually.
John Mark's upbringing. And so that was the culture of the church. So oftentimes people look at us and they go, oh, you guys are doing women eldership. And I'm like, if only you knew, like, there's so much of the story. So just so you know, like, that was the big wrestle. And it was it was different than the sending church for years, because they said, we're going to make you a pastor. We believe you have a teaching gift, so we're going to have you teach. Like, this was very provocative. And truly in our city, even though we're hyper-liberal city, the church in Portland's hyper-conservative. So it's pretty provocative then as well, communally. So fast forward, and I am on the executive, have always been on the elder executive team as a female voice. And part of the conversation we were having was, if I'm sitting here, or other women potentially would be speaking into or sitting in these places, what does that mean we believe?
Yeah.
About this. And for me, the journey was hyper personal, because I've walked the path and I grew up Southern Baptist. My dad's a Southern Baptist pastor. So I have had to do an internal work, a personal work of, what does this mean? And I have all the good part of the Baptist, where I fear God and fear judgment day. I think about that regularly. So yeah. I take very seriously the scriptures and what they have to say. So our committee coming together was a moment in our church story that can't be perceived by everybody, where we have just said, we've been on this journey for years and years and years, and we feel like we've been faithful to the scriptures and want to continue to be faithful to scriptures, but there's a discrepancy in what we want to empower women to do versus what we're actually theologically holding to. So we want to make sure we're theologically where we need to be. So that was the committee. I was a part of that. Read people I had never read. That was part of the interesting part of the journey. I went to a Southern Baptist Bible college, then went to a conservative seminary. And I just read the same voices, the same group of people. So in this journey, we're able to read other voices of Orthodox conservative leaders, but in a different way. And we just wrestled together through it all. It was like going back to seminary, which is brutal. That's not my strong suit. So I was like, ugh. But it led us to a place where we wanted to be strong theologically so that we could be strong pastorally, which is what you spoke to, which is, our heart was that, you know, this conversation has been so tenuous in the world and so divisive for reasons I don't think it should be. And I think it's very much the scheme of the enemy as an affront to the image of God. But I think we put as much effort into pastorally caring for our community in this decision as we did theologically. And that was our commitment from the jump. So because it affects 63% of our church, because this topic for many people is sensitive, because it's new in our community, and because the enemy hates it and hates the church. So we just wanted to be strategic. So that's what we did. I don't even remember what your first questions were, but that was the journey. And then since then, I do remember your last question, which was just, what's it been like? It's been fine. You know, we haven't had any official pushback. The city has had a feeling about it, but not in a bad way. People, you know, it's very, there's a peaceful, very communal spirit in Portland. So we've had dialogue about it. My life, it's not much different. I've had a few interactions, but nothing that would shake the world. And our church has just, and I think for the most part, I would just say our church has unanimously said, this is good and right. And the way in which we've done it has honored our community in the process. And no matter what, that's the highest value. So more chill than what people might think.
Yeah. So what, I have a lot of thoughts from that, but what do you mean like by the city has had a reaction, or like, what has that been like, or what do you mean by that?
I probably shouldn't have said that, but all I mean is, I don't mean that in a way that's like, well, I just mean that When you're a church that exists in a community of other churches and people have differing views, there's a curiosity and an impact on those other communities. So the gift of it, and this I think I would say is an encouragement to anybody who's doing this kind of work, is our questions and the labor we did theologically has stirred up questions in other church communities of like, what should we, it's very Berean. It's like, shouldn't we consider what's being said? And it's, so it's that. So, and when I say the churches in Portland are very close, so they're like our dear friends. Like these are people like, who are like, holy crap, look at you. Like, okay. And that's stirring up questions. So that's all I meant by that. I didn't mean for it to sound provocative because it's not been contentious. No. There are churches who don't agree with us, but we knew that and they knew that when we were already deciding to go this direction. So it has been a lot of just good conversation and that's it. And that's, you know, the gift of, I think, doing it as best you can before the Lord is that it can stir up, it can stir us up to greater love and good deeds, which I think it has done in our community. But it hasn't been without questions. It hasn't been with like, well, what did you think about this? Or where did you you know, you're a pastor. It's just, you're having the back and forth, but overall it's been great. And and not much more of a non-issue, you know, as it could be perceived to be.
Did you personally, because you grew up Southern Baptist, and it's interesting that Bridgetown, this is so interesting to me that Bridgetown used to be a part in some sense of Calvary Chapel. And for you, were you at any point in your faith journey what people would typically think the term complementarian thinks? Like, was that a camp that you ever felt like this is where I am?
Oh, yes, 1,000%. Yeah. Sure. And I would say as a community, we were that way, at least for the first 3 years. And we were still, we would technically have called ourselves soft complementarian in those in between years. But for sure.
Well, and you guys are friends with Gary Brashears too. And so it's not like you're like, we hold complementarians away. But I'm just, this is more of a personal question. So for me, I grew up complementarian. I grew up in essentially, I don't know, Canada's different, but it would be like a Southern Baptist type-ish church. And in my faith journey and wrestling through Bible college and even more studying, I've come to the place where I'm like, I lean towards egalitarian, but there is still that like anxiety you feel, like you brought up, of like, there is a healthy fear of judgment day and whatever. But there is like the thought in my head of like the fear that gets put into you by some people, which isn't super helpful, of like one day you'll stand before God and he'll be like, hey, you messed up. And it was crystal clear. And now you're just a progressive Christian who doesn't care about scripture. For you, and I know that that's not true, but for you, I imagine that there would be, you must have at some point, I feel like, felt a similar anxiety and had the wrestling that I feel. Because I imagine if you grow up or are in that spot, to change any theological belief, there is that like, wow, what if I'm wrong? And I don't know, that like anxiety that comes along with that. How have you navigated? And it's different because you are a woman. For me, I could be complementarian and it doesn't really affect my life that much to some degree. But for you, it is a lot bigger. And so that's also different. But how have you, I imagine that you must have had some of those anxieties and feelings. How have you navigated that? And that's probably my question. It's like, how do you navigate that? Because I still have that feeling occasionally that comes to me of like, what if you're wrong? And and you're just like, I don't know. So how do you navigate that anxiety or that like feel of any theological belief changing? But specifically when it comes to that, how did you navigate that personally? Or did you even experience that at all? Because maybe you didn't.
Yes, for sure. Because I think as Jesus people, we want to honor the scriptures and honor Jesus above all else. So that's like core to my being. I think I navigated a couple ways. One, I had to make a commitment to do my best to let go of my tradition and to bring before God what I honestly saw in the scriptures as it pertains to Orthodox godly people who did the work. And then I read their work, you know? I think it's one thing. So much of, I think, the conversation around egalitarian complementarian is so connected to people's tradition. The fear is connected to the tradition because it's connected to people. So it's fear of man, not fear of God.
Yeah.
So the work we're doing is the discipline I had to do was recentering myself around fear of God, not fear of man, not fear of what my dad would think, not fear of what everyone who in my upbringing world, who I love and respect, would think, not fear of what a man would think in choosing me as a wife. Like, you know, all these things like are real fears. And fear of judgment day, like, what if I got this wrong? That was actually the least fear when I actually honestly looked at it before God. Because when I think about bringing that before the Lord and saying, best I knew how, in understanding the scriptures and studying them faithfully and in giving my life to pursuing you, this is where I landed, knowing that I might be wrong. That feels like, I feel like Jesus, who I know, would be like, I am proud of you, baby. And the truth is, like, and I've heard people say this before, and I really don't mean it in a cheeky way, but I really came to the place in my own life where I would rather be on this side of that story, landing here in this realm of orthodoxy around women being released in their gifting, than I would the other. Saying I restricted many and didn't empower and bless others. So in your faith, that's like one of the things you have to do before the Lord, but it has to be your conviction. And then I did this in the company of many people I trusted and respected. You mentioned Gary Brashears, Tim Mackey is a friend who I sat with. You know, like, God has been gracious in giving me brilliant Bible scholar friends who I'm like, you're so much smarter than me. Tell me I'm not insane and tell me I'm not a heretic. So I just did a lot of that work, and I let myself be vulnerable and exposed to my parents, to other people in this process, my therapist, my spiritual director, and worked it through. Like, and then doing the grief work of what it means that I hold this view now, but I didn't ever exist in a world where this was the thing. So what does it mean I've missed? And those kind of things that are honest to any woman in ministry of like, what does it actually mean now? What else? How else did I do it? Prayer and fasting, like legit just brought myself before God and just said, like, I'm trying to discern this before you rightly. And it's a big deal, because here's the other part that other churches may not have experience. The other part of this that I took very seriously, which maybe I should say publicly or not, but I do recognize, I knew enough to know that Bridgetown does have influence in other places. And so I knew that wherever we landed, people would be listening. And I also knew that I would be part of that, that as being part of this committee and also being a woman who is in executive leadership here, like, that it would matter, that what I did mattered. So I just took it very seriously, because it didn't just affect us in our community, which is a big deal in and of itself, but it also would affect other communities going forward. So I did all of it with fear and trembling, but I did it in community, and I did it prioritizing fear of God over fear of man.
Yeah.
And
wow.
All that was hard, and I'm glad it's done. That's the bottom line. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think you named something that's actually huge, and for me it's true. So I'm part of the Canadian Church Leaders Network. I'm like part of like a emerging lab for younger leaders, and I have a mentor, and I talked about this week actually, about how there is this deep thing inside of me that is a fear of people. And he didn't know I was talking about this issue, but it was about this issue where I was like, on both sides, I fear it's not actually about Jesus. It actually is about the fear of disappointing people I know. And that's a very interesting thing to wrestle to, that the thing that bothers me the most isn't actually whether or not I feel like I've done the work to be able to confidently have a position that I hold with an open hand. It's actually the fear of the faces and letting go of the place you grew up in. And in the sense of like, this is something that I know we'd be at odds with, but I still love that place and have positive feelings, but I know that they would be in a sense disappointed and be like, ah, you're off. And that's an interesting thing to wrestle through, that you go through for a lot of things, but I think is something that's super important. Lastly, because this is a podcast kind of directed towards people who are deconstructing and trying to reconstruct, and you guys at Bridgetown have talked about this quite a bit, I just wonder, if would you have any advice, even though we haven't really talked about it up to this point, but for those who are kind of in that camp of either deconstructing their faith or beginning to reconstruct, would you have any advice or something that you would want to say to them in like 1 minute or 2 minutes? You would say, which is a large question that obviously can't be answered in that amount of time, but is there something that you would want to say to people who are kind of in that spot wrestling through those different things?
I mean, again, if we're just doing like a Hail Mary here, whatever we want to call it, I would just say, don't stop praying. That's like, in my life, in the moments when everything's been flipped upside down and I'm disoriented and I'm messed up and or trying to build or rebuild, I feel like the best thing, the most faithful thing and the most helpful thing I ever did was not stop talking to God when I was pissed, when I was happy, when I was confused and disoriented, when I did not feel like I heard his voice, when I did not feel like he was close to me, when I did not feel like he was real. And in all of those spaces, I just decided I was always going to talk to God. And that, I think, for any person on that journey, I think is one of the best things they can do. And if they can keep doing that, I promise he will talk back. So that's what I would say in my 5 second thought on that.
That's great. Yeah. Bethany, this has been great. It's been great to get to know you a bit more because I've seen you preach, obviously, and listen to your stuff. But to be able to meet you has been wonderful. And so thanks for saying yes to this.
Of course.
Thanks for hopping on. It's been really great getting to know you just a little bit more. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.